For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable.
That's right.
For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you.
That's right.
For the record, lab on me going all the way.
All the way.
For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste.
Stop calling.
For the record. 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 For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable.
Yes, we're on The Clink, Stories of Redemption, Season 7. Wow, how good has it been? Just want to take a moment and say a big shout out to Sideways Surf. Thanks to them, we're able to continue to do this for the next 12 months. And how good is that? Another great episode today. This gentleman, wow, what a story, what a history, what a life. His name's Rick Grossman. He is a musician, and a musician that has performed with the best of the best in the country. Two-time winning ARIA Award artist. Sir, welcome to The Clink. How are you, Rick?
Good, mate. It's an honor to be on here, I must say. Absolutely.
I'm a little bit starstruck because just for the listeners out there, and I'm sure that many of them will be able to relate, iconic and written in history in Australian rock music. It is rock, both, aren't they?
Does that mean old, iconic?
Well, I got to say, you know, if we're going back, I'm 46, and the Divinyls were an amazing band when I was growing up, and I was quite young when I was listening to the Divinyls, and also the good old Hoodoo Gurus. What's my scene?
Well, the good old Hoodoo Gurus are still going. They can't kill us yet. You know, they've tried to kill us a few times, but...
I've heard there's a revival. You're back.
I mean, and we've just put out a new album that came out a couple of months ago, and it actually got up to number two. The Wiggles beat us at number one. Wiggles album.
I've got to ask you something, right? Yeah, now this is the thing, apparently, at the moment, right across the country, the Wiggles. Yes. Even on Triple J, I believe, they hit the hottest 100 at number one.
Absolutely.
Mate, what's going on there?
Oh, they're so uncool, they're cool, you know? And they're great. They're a great bunch of guys, those guys. You know,
they're like a hot potato with a little bit of cold spaghetti. Yeah.
I think there's only one original member now in the band. But
yes, and is that Jeff? Did they end up waking him up?
I don't know. I think it's Anthony. You know, Jeff used to live in a house over on the north side in Sydney. He had to move because so many people were pulling up at his house in the middle of the night and screaming at him, "Wake up, Jeff."
Are you serious?
He actually had to move.
I have a friend of mine, and I don't know if you're familiar with this gentleman, but they call him the Powerfish, William Power. He's moved more houses than anyone I know purely because they pull up. he has this tag called Get the Dog and Bust Up. And people just pull up yelling out at all hours in front of his house, "Get the Dog." Bust up. Rick, anyway, this is about you, Rick, and a fantastic life that you have lived. One that has been an amazing achievement, but not without its ups and downs. And when we talk about ups and downs, some very, very serious ones. I just think that it's amazing to now understand, and I can't wait for you to fill in everybody about, I guess, the truths of Rick Grossman and what it was like being a part of the biggest bands in the world in your era, but living with also a very dark secret, and that was a heroin addiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, sure. I mean, where would you like me to start?
Let's go back to, say, you know, that youthful sort of coming into your late teens. Why did you go into music? How did you get into that? Because I believe that would probably be the starting point of the rest of the story, would it not?
I'd like to start by just saying, you know, I listen to your story, and your upbringing, your youth is completely different to mine, you know. And, you know, I have some great friends, Ronnie being one of them, who have had completely different upbringings to mine. But there was stuff in your story, especially about your youth, that I really related to. And, you know, I didn't come from a violent home or anything like that. I came from a silent home. But I had, you know, a parent just disappear on me when I was 12. And even when I talk about it now, I mean, you know, compared to, you know, I mean, the stuff I heard that what you went through, I mean, unbelievable, mate. But I just shut down, and I started to live in my head, you know, in fantasy, and I didn't want to be where I was, and I felt completely invisible. And my sister, I have a younger sister, and she acted out. She got expelled from every school. She got arrested. She got, you know, all sorts of shit happened to her, and she kind of got to 18 years old and grew up and sort of snapped out of it. I, you know, if you put the two of us together back then and said one of these kids is going to be a heroin addict, for sure everyone would have gone, it's her, you know. And I just shut down. I went really very quiet. And when drugs came along, when I was about 14, I started, you know, stealing alcohol out of my mum's, you know, wine bottles and stuff, and refilling it with water till I got caught. But you know, I when drugs came along, it was like petrol on a fire for me, and I was just like, hallelujah, you know. I suddenly have found my tribe, these, you know, these guys at school, and it was like a magnet for me. And but at the same time, you know, I used to kind of idolize famous people. At first it was football players, and I used to think footy players, and I don't know, are you a Bunnies supporter?
Look, if you look in the background there, that's a Manly Warringah jersey.
Oh, okay.
I was born in Manly, and
okay.
My family all grew up there. I was there. I played in their juniors squad, so
right.
Did my. It's a bloodline thing, but
right.
Definitely not. But I don't mind them. I definitely, they've got a lot of friends there, especially around Maroubra, that are definitely proud Bunny supporters. So shout out to all you Rabbitoh supporters, and we'll leave that one at that. But no.
I did a little gig the other night with Spud Carroll playing guitar.
Mate, what now? Okay, so here we go. Spud Carroll, Manly Warringah, South Sydney.
Bunnies, that's right.
So I can relate and have utmost respect to one of the toughest men ever to get on that field, as far as I'm concerned, to this date. What a legend.
Well, he and Eric Groth were both playing guitar. Eric Groth Sr., the two of them.
Oh, yes, that's right, because he's in bands as well, as his son's an amazing guitarist, isn't he?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And a comedian as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Spud's a bit of a comedian, but not, he doesn't know it. anyway.
Leave it at that, because I know there's some colourful characters that he's knocked around with since leaving football, and they're not very humorous people.
Oh, mate, he's fantastic, Spud.
What a legend.
Yeah, so, I mean, I used to think, you know, if you could get sort of famous enough, or you'd, you know, you'd be noticed and you wouldn't be invisible anymore. And, I mean, it wasn't sort of like a conscious thing that I thought when I was, you know, 14, 15, oh, I've got to, you know, but it was, I sort of saw it as a way out. And, I'd always played a musical instrument, and I started playing guitar and just became completely obsessive with that. And that sort of filled my spirit up. You know, it satisfied me for a while, and there was, you know, a lot of drugs. Oh, it was mainly, you know, acid and pot and alcohol.
Rick, can I just ask you, look, just so we can put this into a little bit of a perspective, how old are you? So we're going back into the 70s era?
I'm
a 76 child, so I was probably still a sperm in my dad's sack
when
this was happening.
Absolutely, 100%. Absolutely. So, yeah, this is like 1970.
Yeah, wow. Where the real acid was real acid.
Yeah. And, you know, there was a lot of heroin that came into Australia around that time because of the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
And I first had heroin in 1974. And I'd been playing with these guys in Sydney who were quite a bit older than me. And they, you know, I had no idea about heroin. I just thought... you know, I smoked it, and I guess I spent the next 20 years trying to recapture that first one. You know, it was amazing.
We talk about different eras, Rick, and we talk about drugs, you know, and I just think it's valid to touch on this point because, you know, the 70s was that era of, you know, the hoochie-goochie, I suppose, the weed, the pot.
Yep, absolutely.
The white night, or, you know, the black tar of heroin and hash.
Today
is an extremely different kettle of fish, but still with the same sort of principles of a generational drug and the differences. Look, I remember growing up and heroin still being a massive epidemic. You know, a young person and a lot of people died that I were close with due to heroin overdoses. And I was very lucky to not, let's just say I was a street kid that literally had a needle put to his arm with 10 units. And I was with an older group of kids. For some reason, I pulled back and said no. And then I ended up feeling a little bit ostracized by it because, you know, I wanted to be accepted and decided to take rivies, I think they were called back then, and seros, handfuls of those. And it was a terrible experience from what I can remember or was told anyway, several days after that. But what I'm getting at, it was such a common thing to be around. Today we see the terrible drug of ice and so many other drugs that I probably couldn't even put into names that young people are involved with. For you back then, was it sociably just an accepted thing to do heroin? I mean, heroin is a scary word.
It wasn't. Look, I used with a few people. There was like five of us, but in my wider circle, I kept it very quiet.
Cocaine wasn't the biggest sort of, like, now every you go to a place now and instead of having a coffee they heat a plate up. It's like a ding party in a microwave. It's such a common thing.
That was the funny thing, you know. I mean, in the music industry, when I sort of came to the end of my drug using, I'll just jump ahead for one second, but I remember, you know, there was all these rumors about me and people who were talking about me were doing tons of cocaine, you know, and it was like,
you were the junkie.
Yeah, you mentioned heroin and it's like, you know, people would grab their wallets and grab their video machines and run away from you, you know?
So
it wasn't, you know, it actually became a part of my life in 1980. I did my first few years in Melbourne playing in bands, and it was definitely around. I had an experience. I lived in a house with Paul Kelly, actually, in 1978.
What a legend in the music world.
Oh, he's fantastic. And he had just come from Adelaide, and we had this house, and I met this girl who was a full-on junkie, and she just robbed us all in the house and OD'd in my room. And I just thought, you know, I'd get her to stop, you know, and I found that wasn't the case. Actually, I must ask you this. I really wanted to ask you this. And I was speaking to Ronnie. Ronnie, you know these people. You know, have you ever heard of these guys in Melbourne? They're kind of old crims called the Allen brothers, Dennis Allen and Peter Allen. They were the sons of Kate Pettingill.
Yes, there was four brothers, I believe, or five brothers. They were stepbrothers and also...
That's right.
Yes, they were involved in some heavy underworld murders and some stupid and disgusting crimes as well.
Yes, yes.
I am aware of these people you speak of. Well, I don't believe any of them are alive anymore. They're all dead, aren't they?
Yeah, I think so. Mm. Well, this is just a little aside, sort of a funny story, but it's, you know, I mean, I didn't have very much, hardly anything to do with crime when I, you know, in my life, but.
Sorry, Rick, you made a very fine statement there. You didn't have very much to do with crime in your life, but functioned as a
heroin addict
for so many years of your successful life. And I can't wait to get deeper into this conversation because once again, the relativeness of somebody who is a heroin addict, well, an addict in general, but preferably a heroin addict, you're a thief. Full stop, because no one can support their habit unless you're a heavy dealer or... you know, in the pocket of someone or selling your body. Yet you were able to maintain discretion, obviously, until everybody sort of realized, and provide your sort of habit daily.
Yeah, very difficult.
Yeah.
So I used to be hanging out a lot, put it that way. And, you know, I was playing in a band that, you know, all the money I earned from the band went on heroin.
So which band was this where we were
at? That was the Divinals.
Wow.
In the Divinals. But before that, I was in a band called Matt Finish. And Matt Finish did pretty well. Everyone in that band was using heroin, but and really, if I'm honest, it's probably what killed the band in the end. But you know, it was an era where the drugs were everywhere, and I don't know how to do this. I'll backtrack a little bit.
You're right, mate.
I'm trying to explain the situation a bit. Well, I'll just tell you this thing in Melbourne where it's a funny story where this girl was a junkie, and she ripped us off, and she was in this scene in Melbourne, which if I walked into the scene now, I know exactly what it was about, but back then I didn't. And it was a very, very closed scene of heroin dealers in Melbourne. And the guys I was playing with in Melbourne, they pointed out this guy, Dennis Allen, to me in the street. And they said, oh, you know, you see him, just avoid him, you know. And they used to point out all the you know, the old sort of Italian crims to me. I used to sit around in Lygon Street. And anyway, I met this girl, and, you know, she ripped us off and did all this stuff. And I was really obsessed with her. And there were no mobile phones then. So I tracked her down. She went missing. And I tracked her down after about 4 months to this house in Carlton. And I went in, and there were these blokes sitting around in this room, and this guy was sitting on the couch. His name's Peter Allen. He was Dennis Allen's brother.
Right.
And he's sitting there, and he said to me, oh, you're Rick. You play in the band. Oh, mate. He was so friendly to me, you know, chatting away. And he said, hey, Rick, we don't think you should see Michelle anymore. Oh, no, he said, I suppose being in a band, you'd really value your hands, right? And I looked at him, and he said, we don't think you should see Michelle anymore. Ooh. To which I heroically stood up and went, Michelle who? And ran out. No, I just left. And I told that story to Ben Mendelsohn. You know Ben Mendelsohn, the actor, Ben? Ben
Mendelsohn? Yes.
And he was in that movie Animal Kingdom.
Animal Kingdom, yes.
Yeah, and he used that story in Animal Kingdom where he plays pretty much Dennis Allen in that movie. That's who he's kind of playing, the character.
Right.
And he murders a girl in the film, and he's sort of really friendly, being very friendly to her. Yeah, he told me that a few years ago. He's an old mate of mine, Ben. And yeah, that was some, you know, that was being threatened by that guy.
Mm? Did you realize the sort of mentality of that person and the ability, I guess, and how far that they would go at that time when you're in present? Oh, okay, so it was sort of that. All right, there could be a fucking problem.
Yes, absolutely. Oh yeah, it wasn't an idle threat, you know. And the way his whole demeanor changed, it was quite scary, you know. He just sort of. Just said, we don't think you should see her anymore.
Right.
So, because I was like an outsider.
You took that advice? Oh, yes.
I did. I did actually see her again a couple of years later. And she, anyway, yeah, very briefly.
She came and
she came around with these tablets called Tuinol tablets.
What? Tuinol? What the hell is Tuinol?
Do you know what Mandrax are? Mandrax tablets? Or?
No, look, I don't. And for our listeners, how about we explain it so they...
Tuinol, they're like Quaaludes. They're the Australian version of Quaalude.
Is that like travel calms?
Oh, no, they're like... Oh, how would you describe them? They're sedatives. Mandrax are like a sedative.
So it gets you stoned.
Yeah, you go numb and fall downstairs and want to fuck everybody, basically.
All right. Don't they call that K today or something?
Yeah, it's probably very similar. probably very similar.
With a twist of Lagactyl Shuffle on the end of it.
Oh, yeah.
That's
oh.
crazy.
Yeah, Lagactyl Shuffle. Yeah.
And
anyway.
What was it like being a part of, and I really would like to share with our audience here, because... Mm. Yes, your story is a very powerful one, but your lived experience and your connection and the things and people that you've made phenomenal. You know, my brother-in-law is very close with Rob Cerullo from Metallica.
Oh.
And, so when he comes out here, they hang. He gets to go around Australia on tour with them. So I've gotten a little bit of that background sort of feel from him, but... I've never had the opportunity to sit down, I guess, with someone like yourself, and I'm a little bit starstruck because a life and era that you were a part of. And wow, the Divinyls, I just truly connected with in my darker times some of their songs. I mean, one of them in particular, I'm On Your Side.
Oh, yeah. Great.
And
song.
It's a very deep song, you know, and something that I've always, even today, would play to listen to. What was it like being with Chrissy in the band? And you know, was there, if I can ask without throwing anyone under the bus, was there anybody else, you know, in that style of addiction as well that you were living with? And
yes.
How was that?
So the band I was in before, Matt Finish, we were kind of doing really well. And this is in 1981. The Divinyls had just started and they used to play with us. And whenever they were playing with us, I'd always go early to watch Chrissy. And I thought they were, you know, I just thought they were great. And I actually thought that they were all really out of it.
Yeah.
You know, they seemed really out of it. And so they asked me to play with them in early 1982. And I was living in a house here in Paddington. And I remember I was sure that Chrissy was a user.
Yeah.
And she had come round. And she and I sort of, even up until her death, you know, we just sort of, we were very, very close. And she was a woman in my life that there was never a grey area. You know, there was never any sort of remotely sort of, you know, sexual thing with her. You know, she was like one of my closest friends.
Best mates, yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. And that night she'd come round and, you know, she liked drinking and getting out of it. And I said, oh, let's have a couple of bongs. And I put some dope in the bong. Some smack.
Snow cone, as we would always call it. Yeah.
Yeah. And she just dropped. She got so out of it, we had to put her in a shower. And I thought, oh, fuck, I've killed the lead singer, you know?
So did she know what you were doing, or was it just part of
the
thing? You were just mixing it up, and it was just like, just a bit of this in, and everyone just get really high and have a good time.
Yeah. It was bad. Wow. It was bad. And I was sure our guitar player, Mark, was just from the way he looked, Mark McEntee, the guitarist. He looked like a junkie, but he wasn't. He was, they like coke and, you know, drinking is, and there was a lot of drugs and alcohol. There probably still is in the music industry, but the heroin was something that I, you know, I'd realised I made a big mistake there with Chrissy and kept it quiet. But our drummer, Richard Harvey, and I became using buddies. And we got into a lot of trouble together, he and I. And he's a great drummer. He's on his last legs pretty much now in a hospital. He went a different way to me when we both, you know, we both used to sort of talk about being a way out. There was no way out of the addiction. And when I first went to a detox and saw that there was a way out, I went and saw him, and he got on methadone and did that. That path, and unfortunately he went back to using and pretty much lost everything, you know, including his health, you know. So I mean, I've seen that happen so much, you know, through those times. And it was funny, you know, because I was kind of saved in a way with the Divinyls, where we in the 80s we started going away a lot, and we'd go overseas for 6 months. And when we'd go, you know, you'd go on an American tour, you couldn't really walk up to somebody and say, you got any heroin? People look at you in a really funny way when you do that. But there was just cocaine everywhere. And cocaine in the 80s in America was like walking to a pub. You know, you walk into a bar and people put it out on the bar. Everybody, it was everywhere. And it was
so
cheap.
So the movies that we have seen made, you know, around that... you know, era, the Miami, you know, bringing it all in into the Miami and the boats and, you know, the flooding of the money and the cocaine and the women. This was a thing. And I guess you being a rock star or a part of a world-recognized rock band, these sort of things, I guess, would have been just at your beck and call, would they have not?
People pretty much.
Made it available for you wherever. I mean, is it true, going back to those days, you know, you would have a manager or a connection and, you know, everything would just be boom. Yep, you turn up and whatever you needed or wanted was there. Or is that just a little bit of a myth when you sort of see movies and stuff about that sort of thing?
Oh, look, I'm sure it happened to a lot of people. I mean, with us, you know, I mean, you're talking about Led Zeppelin, bands like that, you know.
So you got to meet Robert Page?
Right, no. Oh, I have, yeah, I'm Jimmy Page. I just
Oh,
finished
sorry,
reading a
Jimmy
book
Page.
about
So
him.
forgive me.
Yeah, I have. But they, like that, they were in a stratosphere, those guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, they're in a stratosphere. We were like on a bus, driving through America for 6 months together on
Wow.
a bus and staying in hotels. And every club you'd go to, there'd be a club manager who would have Coke,
Yeah.
And our manager had Coke, our tour manager had Coke, all the roadies had Coke. We all had Coke. Everyone had it. It was just everywhere. And you get into this thing where you're just so tired. So you'd have a line when you'd get up in the morning and then just be on all day. And
How was it, Rick, being in that style of life, the go, 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 go? I mean, 1 minute you're recording, you're producing, world hits that, everybody starts to know and sing. You've got to back that up with another EP or a track that's as good or better, staying in that top of the charts. I mean, it can't be easy, surely, and the pressure must have been phenomenal upon you all.
I don't know, mate. I don't know about that. I mean, we look, this was the 80s, and we just did what we did. We didn't really, we'd sort of go out and play, and it was very exciting. Like, it was a time in Australian music that was very, very exciting, and the world was starting to open up for Australian bands. So there was us and INXS and Men at Work and all these bands over in America touring. And
Midnight
I mean,
Oil as well came
Midnight
out.
Oil,
Yeah, wow.
yeah, Midnight Oil.
Wow.
It was an exciting time. And look, playing in Australia, I mean, we talk about this, and my son's a musician, and he says to me, "Oh, you're so lucky, you were playing at this time, a certain time where it was the pub scene in Australia." And first, when we first went to America, we'd see a lot of these American bands who you'd hear their records and you'd see them live, and they were crap live.
Really?
And yeah, and the thing was that in Australia, you'd play 6, 7 nights a week.
Yeah.
And we'd go out to these pubs, mate. I mean, honestly, there was no OH&S,
Nah.
right? There was glass, everyone was smoking. They packed 2,000 people into these pubs. And it was on, and if you didn't perform, if you didn't deliver,
You become the star
you'd
hotel.
oh mate,
Hey.
oh.
Wow.
And it was full on, like, and back then, nowadays the music industry is very professional. Back then, the guys we had working for us in the early 80s were guys who'd been like, they were hard, tough guys who'd been in jail, or they. And they would protect us from the audience, because quite often you'd be playing and there'd be a girl down the front who might smile at you, and after the gig there's eight guys out the back, so one of them being her boyfriend, saying, "Oh, you're trying to pick up my girl," so we'd have to get escorted to the cars and people. I mean, it was full on, it was full
So
on.
the truth about seeing glasses getting pelted on the stage,
Oh.
for bands having a down night, and you didn't perform to the expectations of the crowd, and I mean, I think Cold Chisel experienced that a couple of times in
Oh.
there, because they were massive, obviously, weren't they, in the pub scene? You guys, I mean, within INXS, they were they not so much a pub scene sort of band? Did they
Oh,
just
they
shoot
were.
on a different level, or?
They were. Yeah, they were. Yeah, we used to play with them a lot. They were a funny band. They weren't really a rock band, INXS, they
Right.
were. But Michael was he was an amazing performer. And but yeah, I mean, I got hit by many things over the years. I remember playing at Blacktown RSL one night, and I watched this glass. It was like slow motion, and it was a MIDI glass that had been broken, and it came through the air and hit me on the chest.
Oh my goodness.
And Chrissy stopped the band and went, "Who's that fucking, whatever, And the crowd turned on the guy, the guy who had thrown it was trying to get out,
Yeah,
and the
yeah.
crowd turned on him.
Wow.
But
You'll never
yeah, I
see it
mean,
again. Like, this is the beautiful
no.
thing about your stories and your era. I, as you can tell by my face, I just absolutely thrive on it. Like, I love hearing these older
Oh,
stories,
mate.
and because it
Well.
is something that, if I think I was blessed at 46 to get on the back end of, that end of pub. I remember going to Sweethearts at Cabramatta, and the Screaming Jets played in the Angels. And it was the last time they played there. And I think I was about 17. I've still got the coaster with their signatures on there. And it was just an amazing, amazing night. And then James Rain, I actually ended up being security for him one night in Campbelltown when he was playing a pub gig. And then it just sort of dispersed. And, we went into the Harbour, Parramatta, Sydney, the Collector Taverns and all these sort of things. Mm. And then it just disappeared.
Mm. Yeah, we'd get worksheets, at the beginning of the week, from the agency. It'd be like Comb and Cutter at Blacktown and Family Inn at Rydalmere. And you'd just be like, ooh, this is going to be fun, And it was great. And we'd get the bands I was in, like the Divinals and Matt Finish, we'd get taken out to those big pubs by Midnight Oil and the Angels and Cultures, and we'd have to support them and play to their audiences. So you'd have to be good. Otherwise, you'd die a horrible death. And the beauty about that time was that if you were good live, and there was no internet, right? So people, you'd be able to go back to that pub on your own without supporting, and people would come and see you, and you could build up a following. It was amazing. And us, Chrissy, she used to, dive into the audience and fight people, and
she was a wild one, wasn't she?
Oh yeah, very wild.
Did you ever play at the Entertainment Centre, the Sydney Entertainment Centre, the old one?
Yeah.
Wow. I actually seen Metallica there before they knocked it down and then redid it. And I seen INXS and a few other bands there when I was younger. But what an amazing experience being there. Let alone, I remember, and you would understand this, and a lot of our listeners, that simulcast, you used to be able to put the radio on, Triple M. And it'd have the guitarist.
Kevin Borich, yeah.
Yeah. And you knew. Yeah. And I remember a kid, probably about 12 years of age, 10, and I had trouble sleeping because, as you know my story, I had a lot of trauma, a lot of abuse, sexual abuse. One thing, when they used to do live simulcast on Triple M, and they'd bring out big bands, and they'd play them at the Sydney Entertainment Centre, and you could tune in on your radio and listen to that. I mean, Culture Club, Boy George, I remember, when he came out and it all sort of, and it was one thing that I thoroughly loved and took me away from where I was and suffering and the pain that I was going through. And I can only imagine what it was like for you being on stage.
Well, mate, music was the great escape, mate,
My kids look at me now and they go, how do you know every word, every song, Dad? And I said, because without it, I'd be dead.
Yeah. It's so true. It's so true. And I used to, especially before I started playing in bands, there's an album. One of my favourite bands was The Who. And Pete Townsend would write songs about alienation, about being a teenager and feeling alienated. That's what his songs were about. And I used to sit there just listening over and over, and it was soothing, It was, it was terrific. I just used to go into my head and fantasize and, just disappear in the music. And even today, mate, I reckon that when I'm on stage playing, that's the most comfortable I can feel in myself, because you're kind of free of yourself,
I hear you say comfortably on stage, and I think of Pink Floyd and the song Comfortably Numb.
Comfortably Numb, yes.
What a relevant song to this conversation.
Absolutely.
That had to have been something that, was a massive part of your journey, yeah?
Mate, so people say to me, gee, you must have been out of it, and you must have been this and that. And it wasn't about partying for me, drugs. It was about trying to feel pretty much like I do now, it's just normal. I just wanted to feel normal. And without the drugs, I didn't feel normal, And playing in those bands, the addiction is a very insidious thing. And it starts, they call alcohol the great remover. It removes everything out of your life eventually, and that's what drugs did for me. And it started to remove stuff. And I remember, as a kid, and I used to dream about being part of a gang, part of a band. That's all I wanted to be, part of a band, and maybe even playing overseas and making records. And there I was, and I'm in New York City, looking out over New York City in this great band, and I'm fucking dead inside, mate. I just felt like why can't I feel anything? I just it was like it was happening to someone else, and it was really, it was fucked, you know. It was and people come up and go, oh, you know, it's amazing, you know, you've got this great life, and sure, you know, I mean, I'm grateful that I can play a guitar, and I've been able to do that, you know, but I always thought it was a solution. You know, if you could become famous or, you know, noticed, I thought that was a solution to feeling empty. And
that's powerful. You know,
and drugs, I thought was the you know, heroin, when at first kind of did the job for a little while. And, you know, it's funny, I think there's something in that you said, you know, I have a friend who's a doctor who's in recovery, and he said, you know, heroin, you know, comes from morphine, and morphine was developed for soldiers. Yes. And, you know, someone's had both their legs blown off in the First World War, and they give them morphine. And it's not exactly an anesthetic. What it does is it removes fear.
It takes the receptors, doesn't it? It changes the receptors of the brain to not be focused on that particular thing or area. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, he said it. Yeah, he just said it removes, it acts in a way where it removes fear. And that really made sense to me, because
Rick,
that's what it did
to me.
How
many years of you standing out in front of thousands and thousands of people, taking in this dream of you traveling the world as a musician, and as you said, you know, growing up, that was a dream, it was a vision that you so long wanted to have. But then realistically, you're living in a cloud because you're stoned all the time. How was that transition between times? Because surely there was times there where Rick couldn't get on. And I mean, were you using, or were you only smoking this whilst you were on tour? I mean, how was it to access, and then if you couldn't get it, but you still had to perform, were you performing at what you believed was your best, or were you sick and struggling? I mean, how was that?
Sick and struggling a lot of the time. I would drink a lot.
So would you substitute others for the heroin to try and give you that time to get you through? Yeah.
Yeah, I would have to. Yeah. Quite often, it's a funny thing, you know. I'd be coming off, you know, hanging out pretty badly, and I get to a gig, and you get on stage, and the adrenaline would seem to work.
Yeah.
You know, you could actually get through with the adrenaline, but and then afterwards you just sort of collapse in a heap and maybe try and drink yourself to sleep. Yeah, I mean, that's my life. The last 3 years of the band, or 2 years of the band, was all about trying to, you know, minimizes, oh, you know, it's like coming down, you know, trying to get enough money to use, you know, maybe I'd have enough money to use 4 days a week.
And listen then, to that, you know, you may have enough, and that just puts it in perspective for an addict. You're a part of something so big at that era, you know. I'm assuming that it'd be earning a bit more money than the average person whom...
Yeah, I don't know about that, actually.
Really?
How can I explain this? In the Divinals, for instance.
Yeah.
We were maybe earning, see if I remember, like $300 a week.
Mate, you know, this is mind blowing. This is mind blowing, and I think, wow, thank you for sharing that, because me, myself, picturing you on a world tour, and, you know, like being a part of world's top bands, you guys are living a high life, you know, the dollar's great, you could really do what you want. As you said, you're a functioning addict, so you would, I'm just putting it out there, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners here would be assuming that wouldn't be a problem for Rick to get on and to have his gear and that, because he's got all this money, and he's a part of a famous rock group. So it's not like that.
No.
Wow, let's talk about that, because I think it's really important for people to understand.
Yeah. So in the Divinyls, look, the music industry in the 80s was kind of the Wild West. You know, it was all pretty chaotic, and the deals that bands would sign with a record company, you know, they weren't great deals. And look, in the Divinyls, when we'd say be away, we'd get a per diem. You know, like we might get $40 a day, $50 a day. Plus you'd get your wage, which was maybe $300. You know, Jimmy Barnes, I remember, asked me to play with him in 1985, and he said, I'll pay you $1,000 a week. And I was like...
Was that with Cold Chisel?
No, solo.
Just with Jimmy Barnes, yeah?
Yeah. You know, my best mate is Rob Hurst.
Oh, wow.
Oil's drummer.
Oh, and mate, I'm a big Oil fan. I jumped a stadium fence at 10 years of age, right, at Campbelltown.
Yeah, yeah.
It was the 10 to 1 album, I believe.
Yeah.
And then they did the Diesel and Dust. Diesel and Dust was the first cassette that I ever purchased. And I had the little Sony Walkman that I obtained with the foam wire headphone things. And I made, to this day, even trucking, I'm a long haul truck driver. And when I've driven around Australia, that one album I go to, or albums of, are the Oils, because it's just so relative to every part of Outback Australia and what the lyrics are about. Mm. I made comment, and you can see the excitement of me piping up. How far in advance was their lyrics and music to relevance of today? You know, you're talking 30-odd years ago, and they're talking about relative things right now happening in the world or in the last 10 years. Phenomenal. But
absolutely.
One of my major memories was I was 10 years old and I snuck into one of their concerts at Campbelltown, and in a big football over at Campbelltown Stadium. And I thought, oh, mate, how awesome's this? You know, I'm a street kid and I'm in here and I'm seeing the Oils live. And, mate, can you introduce me to him?
No problem.
Wow, how cool.
So,
all right,
Rob,
now back to you.
Rob, we've been friends since 1977, he and I, when they had their first album out. And we became friends because we were both Who fans. And Rob would always turn up every time. Well, I was living in Melbourne, we'd come up to Sydney and play up here. And Rob would always be this guy. You know, he's a music fanatic, Rob. And he would turn up. Now, Rob Hurst, for me, he drove me to my first detox unit. You know, he's been my... He's like my brother, you know.
That one true friend in life that you could.
Oh, mate, he and I have this band called the Ghost Riders, which we've made 5 albums together. They're all commercial disasters, you know, and they're good, you know. And he's a very special person for me, you know. He's you know, the song King of the Mountain, you know,
I
that
do.
Song.
Yes, of course.
So that was written in my mum's house.
And really?
My parents lived in up the back of Noosa.
Yeah, yeah.
And up in the little towns up there, Pomona and Karoi.
Up there from trucking through there, yeah.
Yeah. And there's a race up the Mount Karoi, up the mountain in Pomona.
Right.
It's called King of the Mountain. And they used to, my folks used to live just near there. And Rob would stay in the house and, yeah. That's where that song comes from.
Isn't that funny? You talk about the relevance to the lyrics and where it was written, and yet most of the people relate it to Mount Panorama and Peter Brock.
Yeah, right. Now, look, the incredible thing about Midnight Oil, I think, is when they did the Black Fella, White Fella tour. Do you remember that?
Yes.
And they, if you listen to 10 to 1.
Yes.
And Red Sails in the Sunset. Those two albums, they've got this kitchen sink on them. You know, they're so dense and there's so much going on. So they go out to the desert with the Warrumpi Band, who are like a country band, right? So it's all really sort of mid-paced. And all the black fellas out there just love the Warrumpi Band, right?
Yeah.
And the Oils had come on and they'd all leave because they couldn't stand the noise. So if you listen to Diesel and Dust, the sound, there's all this space in the music. And that's from the desert. That's from being out in the desert.
Because a lot of their video clips were all filmed in the desert around that.
And it's funny. It's funny you should say. You know, you had a cassette of that.
It was my first cassette I ever purchased. $9.95, I think it was, and it was the Diesel and Dust cassette. Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
I would have been, so, what, about 11? So what are we talking about, 86, 87?
87, yeah.
There you go.
So I was in a rehab.
In 87?
And I was in the rehab for 6 months, and Rob sent me that on a cassette. And I used to walk around. When I came out, I was in a halfway house in Sydney, and I'd catch the train into go to, you know, AA or NA meetings, and I'd just have that cassette on with the headphones.
The little phone ones with the wire on the train. Yeah, that was me, because I used to sleep on the trains at night, and it was my whole way of blocking out the world, was listening to Midnight Oil. And even to this day, they played, a couple of years ago, they played up here at River Stage in Brisbane. I said to my wife, I said, I don't give a flying fuck, we're going. And it was raining, and mate, I was a 15-year-old kid just going nuts in the crowd, and it was unbelievable. And, you know, to this day, I've had the pleasure of meeting some big bands, and as I said earlier, my brother-in-law, you know, he's very good friends with Rob, so, and their team and their managers. I just stood on stage not so long ago in Brisbane looking out at 80,000 people with, you know, a particular band, and then I was standing next to the drummer, and I was blessed to be here. And, you know, there's been, I won't sit here and big note all the names, but we'll talk, we can talk about it. But I've never actually been in the presence of my favourite band, Midnight Oil, or actually got to say hi. that's one thing that, you know, would be an amazing thing. So please, if you're ever on the Gold Coast and you ever hear that they're coming or whatever, mate, I'd love
no
to
problem,
just
mate.
Say g'day. Because
it's no problem.
That'd be so cool.
For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable.
That's right.
For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you.
That's right.
For the record, lab on me going all the way.
All the way.
For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste.
Stop calling.
For the record. For the record, yeah. For the record, yeah. For the record, yeah. For the record, for the record.